The intent of this morning was to make Good Friday an experience in our life, not simply an event many years ago. The intent was to overcome, or the intent is to overcome the idea that it's a day when we feel sorry for Jesus, and that's the limit to what Good Friday is. Attempt to put together Friday and Sunday, which we've tried to do many times in the last 4, 5, 6 weeks, to understand again cross resurrection or death resurrection, cross victory. In what sense is this Good Friday? Why is it not still called Black Friday? Somehow to have it touch our life. The events of this day that we celebrate, Dan, almost always on the charts of liturgy. Have you noticed? Almost always as you move into the liturgy, you move into an experience of a truth. You participate in something. For a while, it's symbolic. Yes, it's in the form of drama. Yes, it's reenactment. Remember is a stronger word than it is for us in Western culture, because all we do is bring to mind instead of re-experience. So remember, we have to even understand it as a stronger word than we usually think of. But it usually is to experience again the truth of that which we've been symbolizing or portraying. And we want to somehow do that today. I'm not taking away from the fact that probably the most traditional thing we can do is both this afternoon when we read the sections of Scripture. I'm not saying what we're doing this morning is more important than that. Or this evening when we worship, without trying to theologize or to make all of this understandable. I think the rest of the day we accept it as something of a mystery, and I still do, and I will not take away the mystery this morning. I simply want us to try to experience the mystery instead of simply talking about it or having it abstract. One of the ways in January when we talked about theology of cross, theology of glory, is that theology of the cross means that it is our experience of cross within our own life and the victory of that, rather than a theology about the cross. I hope you feel that a little bit today. That which happened on Good Friday is not an illustrated lecture by God. It is not an abstract doctrine. It is God entering into our life, and therefore it becomes part of our experience. You can't grab that only by my saying it, so I'm going to try to find ways to do that this morning, and I hope to include you in it very much, not simply give a lecture. One of the most honest things to come across my desk in the last year, honest meaning not introspective, not wallowing in my guilt, not bearing my soul, just a straightforward statement of what it's like to try to do the right thing in this world we live in. Just without self-pity, just a straightforward account of someone who tried to do good, tried to do that which was morally right, and what happens when you try to do that. So I would like you to listen to a pediatrician, medical doctor, tries to function in clinics and in hospitals in an urban setting of the United States, and then respond to this doctor. He isn't here, so we can counsel him. If he were here, I think we would hesitate to give pious advice. I'd like you to counsel on the basis of the good news of Friday to this good doctor who bears his life with us just a little bit. I'm a practicing pediatrician, and though my work is, quote, in the world, end of quote, it also has a reflective side. Increasingly of late, I find myself muttering, for all the good I've accomplished, I should have been a monk. I say this in the negative sense. Then he goes on to explain that he's not being negative about all monasticism, but Saint Benedict did in fact say the monks do not need to wander about outside, for this is not at all good for their souls. He meant he might as well have been in a monastery for all the good he's done. I can handle pretty well the disapproval of those parts of society that I don't respect in the first place, but I have a lot of trouble with what I see as my social impotence and the connivance of government and the law in causing that condition. Let me give a few examples. A close friend, a professor of pediatrics, became head of an anti-poverty program run by a university. A lawyer who was prominent in the area arrived with a law book under his arm and a list of persons who were to be hired for the project. My friend demurred and said, "I hire on merit." The lawyer then opened his law book. It was hollow. Inside was a .45 automatic. And the lawyer said, "This is the law. Watch it." Within a week, the head nurse was raped on the streets. Two assistants' houses were firebombed. My friend got away with having his automobile tires shot out, acid poured over his car. He resigned. Second, I was the medical director for a Head Start program for some years. I was never threatened. That came later. I was totally ignored. I would like to think that this was because I'm younger than my friend, and maybe because I have a black belt in judo. I think, however, the real difference was that I never had control of the money, and my friend did. After 3 years of frustrating watching, I was able to prove that the health care of the children was an illusion, the money had been siphoned. My long documented letter to the local federal anti-poverty office led the officials there to ask the medical society's help in throwing me out as a troublemaker. Three. As chief of staff of a local hospital, I became aware that patients were receiving immense bills from another hospital for simple lacerations. On inquiring, I was told, "Beneath that simple healing cut is a wealth of plastic surgery." So it's billed as plastic surgery. Since I couldn't take the patients apart, the obvious answer was to check the insurance billing records. If all billing was for plastic surgery, credulity would be strained to the breaking point. The insurance companies refused to release the records as the doctors would be offended. As I've personally been so offended at these organizations that I could hardly see straight, I'm led to conclude that an overwhelming desire not to make waves might have been involved. For you who just came in, there might be some confusion as to why I'm reading a pediatrician's journal on Good Friday. I already introduced this in this way. This is some of the most honest, straightforward assessment of trying to do that which is morally right in our society, what happens when you do it, and I want us to try to relate that to Good Friday. I'll go on. He simply has lots of entries. Following these complaints that I made, the medical group of which I was the managing partner was, over a 9-month period, included in 7 separate audits. Each time, the government programs, the insurance for the government programs, the insurance forms handled. Throughout this time, no funds were forthcoming for us. The results of 5 of these audits couldn't even be found for 5 months because of computer error. Finally, our attorney, at $100 per hour of 1968 money, parked himself in the front office of the offending organization, and we were paid within a month. 4. At about this time, the White House asked doctors not to increase their fees. We complied. When a mandatory freeze was imposed, we were charging about 1/2 the rates of many colleagues. Our expenses were not frozen, so we applied for an exemption. Throughout the freeze, every 45-page application was lost, with no exceptions. The attitude of the bureaucrats over these mishaps was very instructive. "My God, Doc, 1/2. Fill out the forms. We lost the last 2. Damn, try again." 5. I was responsible for attempting to remove an obstetrician from a hospital medical staff, one so incompetent that all the other obstetricians on the staff had written letters saying that they would not operate with him. A hearing must be held on such matters. With a duly appointed hearing officer, following the best advice, we called the local bar association, which sent us our hearing officer. Our fatal blunder now emerged. As one of our charges, the obstetrician's performance of numerous female circumcisions was listed. The hearing officer began with that point, with that charge. I would be dignifying his conversation by calling it revolting. What emerged was finally this: "It makes them passionate, and I'll do it to your wife." The charges were then dismissed. No other discussion took place. My only shard of credit here is that my discussion with the hearing officer caused him to leave the building with considerable speed. However, the decision stood irrespective of the evidence actually considered. Now, to reverse the usual societal stereotypes, the hospital and the medical staff, after once more gathering evidence over the next 2 years, paid $8,000 for a lawyer and $2,500 for a hearing officer, a professor of law, and this time the gentleman was nailed. But call it a draw. He continued to practice in the community, not in this one particular hospital. I can hear the response to my tales of woe. Take it to the public. I tried that. Some years later, I quickly gathered support. It turned out most of my supporters simply wanted to divert hospital funds to their own use. It took me well over a year to divest myself of my support. The problems never did get solved. The image of social reformer as prophet has been very illusory in my life. My experiences are only a microcosm of what we know of the world. A recent example being the documentation of the forced repatriation of Russians decided at Yalta. Another friend, a senior medical officer in World War II, witnessed this action in prison camps. He still turns white when he talks about it. He held still while the returnees were forcibly dragged to the Russian troops, who were described as drunk. When the troops began to beat the returnees and to fire into them indiscriminately, he gave the order for the military police company assigned to help with the repatriation to fix bayonets and fire at the next Russian soldier who moved toward a prisoner. Interpreters announced this order over a bullhorn. There was no further repatriation. I think my friend deserves a lot of credit. See the book by Nikolai Tolstoy, The Secret Betrayal, Scribner, 78. It documents that very few had similar intestinal fortitude. Nevertheless, his was not a day-to-day confrontation, but a one-shot act. Day-to-day confrontations require more courage, they are rarely dramatic, and they're hard to feel righteous about. I submit on a day-to-day confrontation with specific problems, and that includes following through until you know whether you really accomplished anything at all, society has ground to a halt. I take Woody Allen's judgment, the lion shall lie down with the calf, but the calf will not get much sleep. Add the moral ambiguity of fate. In Korea, shortly after the war, I worked with an MD, entomologist, a Korean officer, who thought he'd discovered the transmission cycle of Japanese bee encephalitis, a brain fever that periodically wreaks havoc in that part of the world. I reviewed his evidence, and I agreed. As a sideline, unfortunately, he was stealing rice and got caught. As part of his punishment, all of his records were destroyed before I could rescue them. I cannot identify the Korean wildlife thought to be involved. The transmission cycle is still imperfectly known, and the disease still works its lethal course. So the anti-poverty program run by the gentleman with the 45 continues. The nailed obstetrician continued to practice until he overdosed. The difficulties of knowing whether you've done much practical good in the world are insurmountable on two levels. What one accomplishes, if anything, is lost on the actions of the rest of society, and, or two, one's personal life goes to pot. I've known many missionaries and many activists. A few avoid this pitfall. I'm sure I've never met one who has. Either the wife pulls out because daddy is a megalomaniac, or the kids have learning disabilities. Alas, I'm on the side of the missionaries. Could you speak to our friend on the basis of your Christian hope and the gospel and Good Friday? I'll give a start. There's a bumper sticker in Wenatchee, "With Jesus, every day is nice." Will that do it?
I wonder, with a person like that, do they read the same Bible I read?
Who, the person with the bumper sticker?
Yeah, I kind of go, what, do they just ignore a lot of start there, and I just go.
What does Friday and Sunday, death, resurrection, cross, victory? Can you speak in the midst of this kind of world? What do we have to say today?
I don't think that that bumper sticker can speak, or that,
okay,
that kind of understanding can speak in that, in the kind of world that you just read. I think that they have to run courses that are mutually exclusive. I don't think they can. And I think that that's one of the problems that I have, is trying to, not being raised specifically in that tradition, but that kind of Lutheran pietism, perhaps, is the word for it, or that kind of very pious understanding runs throughout myself and where I grew up, and I find it cropping up now and again a lot of times, trying to, if something good happens, say, you know, isn't it nice that Jesus has blessed us? And then if something not so nice happens, then you just fall silent. You don't know what to ask or how to speak.
All right. Honestly spoken. Can you? I understand that I have, well, first of all, we're in the heart of a very difficult theological question. And I wanted to try to get it out of the kind of abstract theology we often do at Holy. When you place it in a particular situation, as though that man were here, and try to say something faithful, it's the hardest fill in the blank I know. So I'm not expecting you to readily jump into this. I am hoping that we all discuss, as Mark has started to, at least our difficulties with it. Don't think that unless you can either cite perfect Yoder or some other thing that you can't enter into this. I want the day to try to make more alive the hope and the faith based on the crucifixion. And so I'm doing it by struggling and making very, very shallow answers that are too easy, because they are not consistent with our experience or the biblical faith. I really want to see the shallow answers as not really helpful, finally. Okay, so any way you want to jump into it, I'll take the steering wheel again, or whatever Erling says, when I feel that I want to go on within the hour. Otherwise, just respond any way you want to. Yes, David.
I think there's a problem with. I would run into a problem just working in the context that I have to say something to him.
All right.
Wasn't it Job's friends that were doing real good for Job until they started quacking at him too much? I've told you this. My dad is headmaster of a Lutheran high school in Seattle, which is just beginning, and right now is going through some financial difficulties. And my dad has really been down about it. And when I was in Seattle, he was telling me about it. And my first reaction was to try and say something to him. And I tried to use a couple of John's bywords, things like, well, are you poor? Are you mourning? Good for you. This kingdom is for you. And I would just start saying something that like that, and I would realize, geez, how do I have the gall to say that? Since that time, I've stopped trying to quack at my dad about that kind of stuff. And instead, I've just been writing him letters more often than normal, perhaps talking about that, perhaps not, but somehow just supporting his personhood. Not trying to fix the situation, not trying to explain the situation, but just trying to be with him as much as I could. And the last time I was in Seattle, he said, boy, that's what I need. In the middle of this problem that he's been having with the school, he said, at last he's getting support like that, and he's feeling like he's not alone in it. And I think maybe that would be a response to this, not to try and fix it or say, let's get a handle on the situation, but just to be with that guy and let him know that he's not alone. And I think that's where the whole, where the cross comes in, you know, because that's the prime example of our Lord being with us in suffering. I mean, he went into it himself.
Okay, Eric?
I was going to say something, the same thing. Well, I think just personally, from a personal experience of the time that we spent in D.C., I remember one incident when our house was broken into and the neighbor leaned across the fence and said, we saw it being broken into, but it's what you deserve, and didn't report it or try to stop it. Or when your kids tell you they've been molested or something like that, if you didn't have the support of a community of people who were living there with you, and many of them experiencing the same things or being raped or whatever, I don't think you could survive in a situation like that, man. So I think perhaps more than talk is simply a community of caring people who just are there when you need them to hold your hand. I think Nouwen says the word care comes from the word kara, which means to weep with. When we can weep with others and be there in your agony.
Okay.
Mark, I think one of the problems with that bumper sticker, the idea is that you try to change, it tries to change what you experience instead of looking at the experience and then trying to deal with it. In other words, when you say Jesus makes every day nice, you're trying to say, well, really, the day really is nice. All you have to do is make it nice. Or, and it's kind of like trying to standing in front of a snow avalanche and throwing snowballs at it, trying to stop it. It just, you're increasing it, the pain and the agony by doing that. So that that's just kind of, seems to me just to be the opposite of what you would want to do in that kind of situation.
Okay. Yeah, Earl.
Yeah, I think one of the best sessions I've heard here was, I think, of the summer of 76 when we had Gordon Lathrop talking about the problem of suffering. And one of the guests was Lowell Wigdahl, who's a psychiatrist in Minneapolis, one of the rare psychiatrists who's also a Christian. And we got talking, Gordon got talking about the testimonies of people who suddenly had reservations for airlines canceled, and lo and behold, the plane crashed. And wasn't God blessing me by canceling my reservation? And Gordon was really upset, and he said, what about the people who died? Was that God's will? Why didn't God cancel the reservation of those people also? With this, and then Lowell got talking about some of his problems every day, seeing people, not only as a physician, but as a person who cared, about something more than simply getting themselves together. And the way Gordon put it is, I can't do it well, and it is on tape here. I think it ties in so well with Good Friday, is that we're not alone in our suffering, and that we can understand that Christ is with us all the time in our suffering, and that we can't work our way through it ourselves. But if we understand and can come some way identify and relate with the kind of suffering which Christ went through, knowing this, even from the beginning of his ministry, that's the kind of strength and support, even though you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, that's available for Christians. And there isn't anything more than that. And we shouldn't expect that it's going to be a nice day at the end. That the end, that the suffering is necessarily automatically going to be redemptive. That's the trouble. That's one problem I find, is that suffering is automatically going to be redemptive, and oh, how I suffer now, but it's going to be okay pretty soon. With this, because and Lowell could cite so many cases where it doesn't seem that way at the end. But people try very hard, like your physician friend and all the rest, and suddenly there is no redemption at the end, or obvious redemptive quality. But all that there is the example of what we have. In the ultimate form of how God himself suffered for us.
And the promise of resurrection.
Okay.
It, the
the thing that struck me, I affirm strongly what David also says about the aloneness of it. And when he talked, I thought about Jesus in the garden. He went off by himself to pray, but he also wanted his disciples to be praying. And he said, pray that you may not pass through temptation. It's sort of like we're in this together, but we're in it separately too. But the thing that struck me was, I'll bet that everyone in this room has got some resonance with what this doctor is saying. Only for a lot of us, and I certainly myself, have not been so righteous that someone has waved a 45 at me and says, here is the law. I mean, long when I can just smell a 45 way at a great distance, I'm capitulating. But to hear that testimony is encouraging. There are some people out there who will go far enough that they actually see the 45 and have it waved at them. And maybe, you know, hard to tell what's going to happen to this guy. If he keeps on going the way he's going, he might not live to an old age. So if he's got some people around him who understand that, he'll have his company.
Marion and Dan.
Well, is there a thing I've come to realize more and more? As a Lutheran, my indoctrination that I have nothing whatsoever to do with my salvation, that it's God who does the work, I'm very willing to, at least intellectually, and I hope within my whole gut, accept that. But I never take it like Yoder says and take that same abandonment to the God of history or to God's will in my relationships with other people. When I think of during the 60s and 70s, how frustrated and angry I would get when things didn't turn out right or when the program we started folded for lack of something or other. I mean, just kind of felt that if you didn't personally see that it got done and if it failed, that was somehow, you know, something about you that was wrong, instead of, again, doing what you know you had to do, responding as you were able, and letting God do with it what he wants to. But I think that's very hard for me to do, because I have to manipulate it and make sure that it's coming out right.
Dan?
I was going to say, what were you saying?
Let's turn it just a little bit. Go ahead, Spence.
I just wanted to ask a question. This is not keep it back into the realm of theory sort of thing, but just a little bit of what some of our experience with Yoder. So much this seems to be almost the prime example of the almost the Herodian example of trying to work with the powers that be, and so many of them are just inherently fallen or something, and just. I guess he being a pediatrician, and my mother's a pediatrician in public health, and I just mirror images what she goes through, and you know, coming home day after day after day and just screaming at the world.
You tell me if I'm unfair to what you've just said. The thing I link up with that is, how about the advice, why don't you find two or three other Christian doctors and nurses and get out of this public head start and what have you. Your trouble is that you're not with other Christians in a clinic you can run yourself. How do you like that one for Good Friday?
It's too easy.
That's what the disciples...
I kind of like the idea of it a little bit.
Pardon?
I kind of like the idea of it a little bit, but, you know, this book came in your books. Well, I saw it's called Servant Leadership. And the Erling kind of ordered for the hold, and I got kind of pepped up about the whole concept. It's talked about leadership in universities and the growing edge of the church and trustees and things, and how they would develop this concept. So then I come into here and hear that little story, and I think, boy, you know, I don't want to pay that price. But maybe the hope is, so I see hope in it, maybe the hope for that doctor and some others who want to be involved in leadership and know the price that you pay for it, need to have the support of a few others around that can help them overcome a few pitfalls and still continue rather than give up or not try. I think support is really needed.
Okay.
This probably sounds too academic, but Robert Elwood makes a difference between the temple, a religion of the temple, and the religion of the marketplace. And I think there's a real danger with your getting a little Christian clique together of having just a religion of the temple instead of a religion of the marketplace where you go out. I think Christians need mutual support. And all that goes along with this, but unless they're out in the marketplace, you know, where everybody else is, I think they simply become, you know, a world unto themselves and have simply isolated themselves into a sect.
That doesn't mean you're not out in the marketplace. You know, I don't think that's mutually exclusive.
No, but I mean, if you, for instance, get a reputation as, I know, I can't mention his name, at St. Paul, he counsels only Christians, and charismatic Christians at that, then I think he's missed the point altogether.
Yeah, but we took one woman in our parish, had an idea of how to get people housing, and moved 35 people into their own homes when the District of Columbia had done absolutely nothing. I mean, she got a group of Christians around her and worked to do it the same way the Church of the Savior. They emptied Junior Village of its overpopulation of orphans and delinquents. When the government was, I mean, they just said, we're going to have nothing to do with the government. We'll just go ahead and do it. And with support of other Christians, I mean, maybe that's not what you're talking about.
That's not what I'm talking about.
But yeah, John, you're talking about kind of escaping and saying, listen, we'll be with Christians, nurses, doctors, we'll operate and work with Christian people who won't deal with the world, who won't look at what's going on in the world today. That would be wrong, but I think that getting support for a way you believe is necessary, and I think that you can just kind of end up feeling like it's just all futile if you don't.
Okay.
That's just a very real struggle for me. I don't think it's an easy one, whether or not you work within the system or try to work outside of it, whether you say the Pledge of Allegiance or you don't, whether you vote or you don't, or whether you become a member of the ALC or a member of Central Lutheran Minneapolis or start your own little community. And it's just a very, I don't have any answers, but
it seems like he's so deeply involved in this thing that, and he's put so much time and effort into it, it would seem like a waste for him to willingly pull himself out of that. But it might be that if he keeps on trying to do stuff, he won't have to pull out, because he'll be thrown out. I mean, he'll be pushed out if he makes himself enough of a nuisance. And that'll be the time when he might have to search for another way to do what he sees needs to be done. Or maybe his role will narrow more and more as the pressures increase, so that he again will be forced to look for other ways. And I sense that in what Mary was talking about. These were some people who had something to get done, and then they just looked around and used any way they could. Whether or not anyone else had defined that as a possibility, they just went ahead and did it.
Go ahead.
Slight exception to the use of it would all be a waste, because I think I'm having trouble saying whether it would be a good thing or a bad thing. I have trouble with those words in the first place, but whether it's a good thing or a bad thing for this doctor to get together with some other doctors and start a little Christian ministry. I think it would be a bad thing for that to happen if the reason for getting out of what he's doing now was because it wasn't accomplishing anything. You know, if he keeps plugging away because he feels that is the way that he can live faithfully, then, you know, I think he should stay. And if he would leave just because it's not accomplishing anything, I think that's being in the wrong question. That's where that whole question of it would be a wasted effort comes in. But I'm not saying that certain people, perhaps him in certain situations, might find the way to respond faithfully would be to work with some other Christian physicians and somehow set an example. I'm having a hard time
I'm gonna stop the flow of that one. I think the strategy of the pros and cons of that strategy might get us a little farther away from Good Friday than I want. It's an important next step. There's a couple other things I want to center on today in Good Friday. Can you imagine the traditional way in which we have preached the Good Friday Easter sermon that simply does not respond to this man and the world as he's experiencing it? I started with the bumper sticker because Tom Halverson saw that in January, and in our discussion of Cross and Glory, he said, well, I was out in Wenatchee and I just saw this bumper sticker. Can you get some of the other ways in which we have attempted traditionally, historically, to speak to this person, and let's test how helpful it is, how real it is, how gospel it is? What are some of the other ways we've done traditionally? What does Good Friday say to this medical doctor trying to be a pediatrician in the inner city?
Well, some people would say that's a political, economic realm. This has to do only with your spiritual life.
Okay, your sins are forgiven. Is that helpful? Your sins are forgiven.
I think if you want to make it exclusive, it's not. If you want to say that it's, I think that it is very helpful to say your sins are forgiven in a very positive, in the way of saying that it is not finally perhaps your accomplishments, or it's not what Mary said about it. It is not finally what you do that makes the merit, makes the difference, and that you have failed in your doings. And I would really not want to throw that out and say that's not
okay.
That's not helpful.
If you don't throw it out as not helpful, is his major problem an overwhelming sense of guilt, personal guilt? It doesn't seem like it, does it? That's not the only good news I need, that my sins are forgiven. All right. How about this life is a veil of tears, but we're only pilgrims and strangers here. Heaven is our home. Would you, if you came to church on Good Friday and Easter and were this pediatrician, would you feel that they'd been right in the middle of your present experience with that one?
So many of those messages seem to focus so much on Christian individualism rather than Christian community, or the call to community. And, you know, it's fine for me to say this is, you know, my world is going to be a veil of tears, but when I get to heaven, it's always focusing on I. The call to community seems to be so much more than the new covenant, and I don't think those messages speak to that.
Other responses to that kind of use of Friday and Sunday, that after you die you'll go to heaven, kind of, I'm using shorthand, and when you do it's dangerous, but that if that was the basic thrust, how about that's life, that's what life's all about, and that theology of the cross means gloom. Are you happy with that?
I don't know how this answers your question, but it's something that I feel that I'm learning and I'm beginning to see. Tendency is to naturally feel that I want to rid myself of struggles and problems and uncertainties, and then things will be all right, and that's mm-hmm. what we strive for. And I'm beginning to see that that if I cleared up certain struggles or uncertainties, I just have other ones. And that even if I did rid myself of all uncertainties and all struggles, I mean, would I really be alive? I mean, it's just a part of life. And and the thing to strive for, or something that seems to give it a clearer picture, to accept the struggles and accept the uncertainties, that they are going to be there, and that is kind of what adds to the fullness of life.
Okay.
To have that.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we have really bought the idea that suffering is to be avoided at all costs, as Jim Carroll says. That illusion of, not that it's redemptive, but I think Debbie's right. It makes us less human not to suffer. I mean, I don't think I'm a very deep person because I've never really, maybe that makes it really, I've never really suffered like that man has suffered.
David?
But to counter that, it's been a smaller movement, but there's also been a movement that has turned suffering itself into something noble, and I don't think that's what we're after either.
Mm-hmm. Try to persecute it, I must be doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, look at those poor people, how noble they are. Yeah.
Can that also be a misuse of Friday and a misuse of theology of the cross? Sure can.
It seems like we either revel in the glory or that we concentrate on the darkness instead of the light coming out of that darkness.
Okay. All right.
Could we, in relation to what both Mary and Debbie had said, could we just listen to what he has to say? I think it was not an accident that we had nothing to say after you had read it. I sense that part of it is, I mean, Mary, you mentioned, I also don't feel as though I have sensed much of the suffering in the world. I mean, he sees it. He brings it out in front of us. But I haven't experienced fully what that is. And I think part of one response is to listen. It's just to open up and say, here it is, and what do we do with it? What can we do with it? There it sits. And kind of feel that uncomfort fully, feel that horror fully.
But the reason I haven't suffered is that I haven't been out there where suffering takes place. If that's what I mean, not that I seek it, but I have to continue to ask myself, how can I understand Christ's suffering or have the foggiest notion of what that means if I was really counterculture to the world and out there doing the things that Christ wanted me to do? I would be really suffering. But if I haven't, have I so insulated myself with a cozy community of Christians, or do I just choose to be up in the mountains where no one can get at me, or what?
The dialogue, the last three responses, Luther, I should have brought my notes on theology across, and I didn't, I'm sorry. Luther has, he breaks into the middle of that, and a theologian of the cross is one who is in the midst of that kind of vulnerability, at least, or he's not a theologian. In other words, Luther comes very close to saying that if you have insulated yourself, not that you've sought the suffering, but you have been obedient, which will mean that there is a measure of suffering. Unless the theologian has been obedient enough that this is out of his experience, it's not really theology of the cross. It's theology of glory about the cross. Then it's an abstract ideology. I said that at the beginning. Maybe now you understand a few of Luther's words about the difference between theologian of the cross, theologian of glory. I also hope that at this point you could better understand the first part of Douglas John Hall, Light in Our Darkness, when he tries to write about an indigenous theology of the cross. He says what we're going to have to keep in balance is experience, that's the pediatrician, and expectation, that's some measure of hope, that this is not the final word, that's life, too bad, it is a veil of tears. But the typical expressions of that hope, someday you'll go to heaven or other things, simply do not bring the kind of good news. I have tried to think in terms of preaching to this person on Friday. And that's what we've been attempting to do. But do you sense keeping some kind of balance of expectation and experience? That's the balance of death, resurrection, cross, victory, Friday, Sunday. That's the mix of Holy Week, and what we're trying to do is to feel it a little bit here this morning. Let me do two things, and then we'll have some further discussion because we're getting close to the time. I'd like to read to you Douglas John Hall's more theological way of saying what the first three of you said, and that is one of the first things is to stand with this person. To say something in the midst of, not to try to deny this is your experience, not to try to deny that, but somehow to stand with it. That's the essence of theology of cross. Ferdy picked probably the best title for a book on theology of cross, Where God Meets Man. That's the primary thing theology of cross is talking about, and Hull says that very well in one page. I'm gonna read it slowly. I've already apologized to the winter program. I don't like to have people read to me from a book when I'm not looking at it, so it's not that long. I think it's worth listening to. There is, all the same, no immediate connection between pessimism and the theology of the cross. Theology of the cross does not mean primarily or finally gloom or pessimism. Paul's going to show what it does mean, and it does not mean that. That's the first thing people tend to think. If you say theology of the cross, they're going to assume, oh, you're gloomy instead of a happy Christian. Every theological posture has its danger. No doubt the danger peculiar to the theology of the cross is that it readily lends itself to religious pessimism, melancholia, despair. But something altogether disruptive must happen to this theology before it can become the vehicle of religious pessimism, i.e., it must cease to be a Christology. I'm going to go over that. If you get that, you get the whole morning. If you don't get that, all of our talks about pediatrics in the inner city are going to... All right. Let me read that once more. In order for the theology of the cross to be misunderstood as simply pessimism, something would have to happen. Namely, you'd have to take Jesus out of the theology. Then you might have religious pessimism. Then you don't have any theology at all because you've just removed Jesus from it. I'm going to go on, and that's going to become a little clearer, but I want to make sure you get it first. The theology of the cross is primarily a theology of where Jesus meets you. It's not primarily a theology of whether life is gloomy or not. He happens to meet us in our gloom because that's the nature of what life is like. The good news of the theology of the cross is Jesus meets us where we are. We don't have to be someone else or live some different place in order to meet him. I'm looking at you. I can't. Okay. All right. I got it. All right. Quiet, whip. It must not be overlooked that the whole intention of this theology is to bear witness to the incarnation. I propose that one of the most profound Good Friday photographs we've had is Grunewald. If you came into a hospital and every patient there suffered that awful disease with all those red welts, if your living hell was a whole body that itched, and the crucifix showed a Jesus with your disease, that's what the Grunewald did. Remember the other night? That's theology of the cross. It's saying visually, Jesus meets me where I am. That's what that photograph tried to say. The theology of the cross is, first of all, a way of speaking about the character of God's entry into the sphere of human history. It is not a statement about the death of Jesus, but about his life and the meaning of his life for our lives, as well as a statement about his death. It is not merely a statement about the human condition. It is testimony to the assumption of the human condition by the one who created and creates out of nothing. Now, the basic point of this theology is not to reveal that our condition is one of darkness and death. It is to reveal to us the one who meets us in our darkness and death. You sense the difference? Okay. It is a theology of the cross, not because it wants to put forward a ghastly spectacle as the final statement about life in this world. Good Friday is not feel sorry for Jesus. It is not to take delight in a gloomy picture of a man with nails through his hand. That is not the point of it. It is not to put forward a ghastly spectacle about this as the final statement about life in the world. That would be to end by telling him, well, that's life. It insists that God, who wills to meet us, love us, redeem us, meets, loves, and redeems us precisely where we are, namely in the valley of the shadow of death. It is the repudiation of a theology of glory, not because it is masochistic and mistrusts or despises man's search for happiness, but because it insists that authentic happiness can only be found as we confront and enter into that which under the conditions of existence negates and dispels happiness. Devis. It says happiness will be found only when you enter life, not try to get rid of the suffering in order to live. You'll enter the next suffering. Tom Witt. You do not find light by denying the darkness. You move into the darkness, and that's where Jesus promised to meet us. Lots of people have been saying stuff that leads into what Hall is now saying. Now the Beatitudes, what do they say? As pious advice to him, they didn't ring true. As an understanding of the fact that Jesus meets us where we are, blessed are the poor, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are those who are persecuted. The theology of the cross finally declares, God is with you, Emmanuel. He is alongside you in your suffering. That's the first thing we could do, is like Job's friends, who stood there for 7 days and didn't say anything. They were doing fine. It's when they opened their mouth that they blew it. For 7 days, they just stood with him, said nothing. Sometimes when you enter a hospital, just remember that all you have to do is maybe grab the hand and squeeze it and say nothing. A tear might be all right, too. The main thing is not to say if you have enough faith, you'll be able to laugh this off or some other stupid thing. He is alongside you in your suffering. He is in the darkest place of your dark night. You do not have to look for him in the sky or beyond the stars, in infinite light or in glory unimaginable. You take the theology of glory to its final thrust. God loves a winner. And you try to bear that in your own life. You try to constantly be a winner, because in your theology, if you aren't, God loves you. And I don't know anybody who can bear that burden. Can you sense the final outcome of only the successful are really God's chosen, and then you've just got to keep succeeding, or by golly, I fell from grace? It's a horrendous burden. Theology of cross finally says you don't have to carry that anymore. The outcome of that, which over much media, TV, religion today, seems like good news, is an awful burden. Awful burden. I can't take time this morning to open that up, but I think you get some hint of it. It says God is alongside you in your suffering. He is incarnate. That means he has been crucified. That's Good Friday. He has been crucified. He stands at that place that you could say was the worst of suffering. To become flesh, to become one of us, means not only to be born, but also to die. It means to fail. It means that he has been crucified, and therefore that the way of the cross, which is in any case our way, that's what life is like, need not be regarded any longer as producing only negative results. There may be, after all, a kind of expectancy that's not extinguished, but actually springs into life through the experience of negation. Theology of the cross says God meets us where we are. For your...
John, where we are can also mean, I mean, I don't, it always is focused on our, in our despair, but it's also in the most, in our joy.
It's in all of life. And if you live life to the fullest, I think the doctor, it may be a somewhat outstanding, or it may be a somewhat unusual thing that you can list 5 or 6 straight defeats over a 3-year period of time. But if you live out that kind of obedience, I think you'll have something of that kind of experience. And God meets you at that point. Meets you in the point of your weakness. Meets you where you actually live. That does not mean there aren't any good times to life. No.
I mean, just...
I think when our first baby was born, it was one of the most joyous experiences where I felt God in my life more than at any other time. That was certainly not a gloomy, horrible experience. It was utter joy, and I would not like to think that God wasn't there sharing.
All I can say is theology of cross does not deny that, but I don't know if I have time to back up. All I can say is no, it's not denying that. Is that enough?
Maybe it's in the extremities of your feelings, you know, either extreme joy or extreme sadness. It's in that extreme feeling that we know we're alive because we feel so much. And when we know we're alive, we can feel God in life.
Let me give you the. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was going to say, or is it in the places where you finally don't even it's like when in those places and times of extreme joy, then it seems like almost a natural thing to give thanks.
Yeah.
And you want to thank, you know, your husband and your baby, everybody, but in times of real despair, then there is you don't feel so that God meets you where you don't feel like God meets you, and then it's not. So it's kind of God really coming to you instead of you having being able to give thanks. God comes to you, and then things happen.
These are the reasons that Luther talks about the hidden God, that only through faith could you understand God meeting you in your moments of weakness, that wisdom can see the blessings of God when everything is going well. That, a theology of understanding the natural, that when things are going well, there is a kind of providence. Wisdom can see that. Wisdom cannot see the scandal of a crucified God. That's faith only. By the way, Luther's quote, "Reason is a whore," is at this point, he's not anti-intellectual at a lot of points. At this point, he said, reason will never bring you an understanding of the crucified God. That's by faith only. And if you want to do some reading today in your quiet time, read 1 Corinthians 1, 17 through like 2, 5, that whole section, since they could not find God by wisdom, it was in the scandal of the cross. The cross is a stumbling block to Jews, foolishness to the Gentiles, but to us who are being saved, that whole thing is very, very close to what we've been talking about this morning. I want to give you, as a final thing, a little more background of the medical doctor. This was sent to me by an inner city pastor that I met, and was one of the first things that spoke to his condition, because he does live in a church, and it is ours, the ALC, where most pastors have enough successes that keep them going. Statistically, building program, people there on Sunday morning. And he simply does not have many people who stand with him in a situation where there are not many reasons to see God's blessing. There are not many people. This is very typical to his daily life. You try to push something and you get your church bombed or whatever it is. You win a few and you lose twice as many. This was one of the first things that spoke to his reality, this article. So even though I don't know the doctor, I know the pastor who sent it to me, and we had a good long talk. Secondly, I want to tell you where the doctor comes out in the article. We should be, even though some of the stuff we said was pious advice, if you try to answer it as a kind of prescription, a pill to hand when somebody's in this condition, part of the Christian faith is to understand some helps in the midst of this, and he comes back to his first statement. For all the good I've accomplished, I should have been a monk. And what he decides to be is to continue to be a pediatrician with a practice in the inner city and a monk. And it's a fascinating thing. What he does is keep canonical hours. And that includes some people who stand with him. But the conclusion, even though it's not specifically Good Friday, I just want to give you a couple of the things that he has at the end. Creativity is taking what both disturbs and exalts you, internally and externally, and wrestling with it, reforming it, struggling with it, until somehow you have altered both it and yourself. It is the refusal to accept at a gut level what other people say about what's important. I seem to have come almost full circle. I began by complaining that my best efforts led to nothing except possibly defensive hostility. I'm now advising that one's best efforts must finally be judged by wholly different standards. You've got to be a contemplative in a world of action. He is now a practicing physician who is also a little bit of a Thomas Merton. It simply finally came to be a different way of seeing. I'm not sure that we could have brought him to that with what we said. Maybe finally today what we could have done is to stand there with him, or to move into the inner city and to become part of a covenant community around a pediatrician. I was once with a group where that was the case in Philadelphia. One of them was a practicing medical doctor, and the rest moved into a house and became a covenant community in the midst of a kind of tough situation in Philadelphia. But anyway, I think he describes life as it is. I think he in a straightforward way talks about the human condition, and I think more than any other theology that the world has batting around, and there are lots of them, I hope you know that, a theology of the cross, which is the treasure that we have been permitted to receive through a long history and lots of struggle. And frankly, Douglas John Hall is right. It has always been a minority view within Christendom since Constantine. Christendom today in the world does not basically hold a theology of cross. It has a theology of glory. I'll be presumptuous and say that the American Lutheran Church is primarily theology of glory, not theology of glory. That in the mainstream of the American religion today, I just don't want us to settle for anything less than the gospel.